Our brother Frank Abel will now lead us in the second session entitled Israel Back in the Land, the Key Marker. Brother Frank.
Well, to a Christian elephant community, that doesn't really need to be said. That I'm sure that that's the way we view the people and the land of Israel as our key marker in prophecy. Not only that they are his witnesses in many ways, but primarily to the fact that he is God, but they're also the witness by which we get to know where we are in history and what we should expect next. You're on page 3 in your notes. Just like to make a comment or two about Ezekiel 21. Because there are many passages where if we've had to actually maintain our view in the light of some who argue against us or do not believe this, and we know, and I'm sure that you've found this out too, that there are many Christian communities who do not share our belief about Israel and would contend that God is finished with these people because they have rejected his son. It's therefore needful for us to be able to defend our view and to sometimes find the key passages. Well, Ezekiel 21, when it talks about the demise of Israel at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the prophet speaks in verse 25, "Thou profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day is come, whose iniquity shall have an end. Thus saith the Lord Yahweh, remove the diadem, take off the crown. This shall not be the same. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him." Now, it is only one word, but what a powerful word, until. It's like the Apostle Paul building his case about the seed of Abraham being Christ on the fact that it was singular, not plural. Now, this has no meaning at all for a lot of people. You just think for a moment. If you thought that the scriptures were really just the writings of men, or that they were not just the writings of men only, but they were the mythical writings of men, then these points are not of any consequence. They certainly wouldn't hold any weight for a person to argue, well, he does say until, for a person who says the whole record's myth. It's only a few people who actually believe that the record can be used that way in the world today. And I'm sure that if you've been active in the seminars, you've got to be impressed. The tremendous gap between people who read the Bible and put it like we do in the place it is in our life and the general public. We have a chap come up to us, the fourth seminar. And he's the only person that signed up to this seminar with letters after his name, but we never could figure out what they meant. But he came up to me and he said, look, I can follow you people. I understand what you're saying about the books of the Bible. Obviously, he didn't know much about the Bible, but he says, I understand that. But I says, I can't understand what these numbers are afterwards. Well, we put a quotation up. We have chapter and verse. He never noticed chapter and verse. No idea what they're for. I thought, boy, I tell you, we're not getting down far enough to where people are. And I think we do that all the time, brothers and sisters. In our own community, we can talk about things that we really can't even mention to other people because they don't have an idea what we're meaning. But in that record, the word until is critical. It wasn't that he overthrew it forever. Clearly, the record says there were three overturnings, although one might say, well, that's just an expression of language. But he does say until. And the key, as I've shown in the notes, is to be able to go to Luke and to see that the word is used again in Luke 21. But first of all, in Luke chapter 1, the answer to Ezekiel 21 is in Luke 1, verse 32. He shall be great shall be called the Son of the Highest, and the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. Now just think of how much privileged or how more privileged we are that it went on to say the throne of his father David. So that we're not left in doubt about Ezekiel 21 as to what this really meant. The throne was being dealt with here. Remove the diadem, take off the crown until. And then this announcement of the coming of the one who would be called Jesus, who would be given the throne of his father David, and who would reign over the house of Jacob forever. Of his kingdom, there would be no end. See, we're looking for proof, brothers and sisters. We're not just looking. We're looking for proof. And I appreciate any of you would talk to us and, you know, say, well, I don't think that's proof, or have something else to say in our breaks. I appreciate that very much. Because I think that's the basis upon which we see Christadelphians rising above the average, is when people feel, hey, that's proof. There's a conviction that arises out of proof that overcomes the fear and the trepidation that sometimes people have of ever opening their mouth about these things because, hey, maybe we don't know enough. How many people have never got involved in the work of the truth because they didn't feel they were prepared? We're never prepared. We're never that prepared. You could study all your life and never be prepared for everything. But if you get out and get involved in it, and you find out that people don't even know what chapter and verse is, you find that maybe we are very prepared, much more than we ever thought. The problem was purely up here. We have a barrier in our mind to going out and working. It's not reality. Now, one of the things that I'm going to try to elaborate on extensively in this is the way we're dealing with Scripture. I think it's very important that when we use Scripture, we are some way, we have some positive evidence it's applying to our day. Like there would be many things that you could open up and say, well, you know, there it is. It's telling us what God is going to do. But how do you know it applies to our day and not to some other age? Now, that's where we want to have proof as well. Otherwise, I suppose you could make many, many cases that really don't stand the test of time. One of the things that I don't want to take too much time in fact, very little time in, is our heritage on this. You just look at the number of books that you could find in a Christadelphian library on Israel, starting back from the time of John Thomas, and then working ahead. I mean, in every editor of the Christadelphian, this has been something whereby we've seen them do some elaborate writing. There have been books produced. There have been some excellent books produced just recently on Israel that document the Christadelphian connection to Israel as far back as anyone can remember. Our belief, our hope is tied to these people and what's happening to them in the world. And I just hope that we can maintain that in front of our children. It's like when so many things are happening that people aren't impressed by them anymore, it's much more difficult to make these points. There may very well be some of you here that can remember back to when some of these very significant dates in the history of Israel actually occurred and what the Brotherhood thought in those days. Now, that's the kind of thing that I think needs to be said over and again in front of our kids. They didn't experience 1948. They didn't experience 1967. They had no idea what the community felt like in those days. But to think that here was something that was happened that was prophesied 2,500 years ago, and we are privileged enough to see it happen in our day, is like the people who were privileged enough to witness the birth of Jesus and his ministry. And you see that written in the earlier parts of Luke, of those who were expecting the occurrence of the Lord, and how great they must have felt when these things occurred. Now, it's that thrill, brothers and sisters, which is contagious. But without the thrill, it's just dead. How do we expect our kids to ever be thrilled with something if we're not thrilled with it? We don't show that we are. We don't really mean it. We don't do something because of what we believe. And that's the kind of thing that has to be communicated, as well as the actual teaching of the word. It's one thing to go through Sunday school and say, well, this is what we believe. But when the kids look around, well, who really believes it? Like, who's doing anything different? Who speaks, very enthusiastically about what's going on in the world? If that's not occurring, then we're losing it. We're not really fired up like we ought to be about the signs God's given us to illustrate that we are living in the days of these prophecies. I think one of the greatest inventions, which all the inventions of men have got their major problems as well, but the internet is just giving people access to all the libraries of the world in their own house. And there's no reason why we can't, just by turning something on and getting the right search words, of going through and picking out the critical documents relating to any particular time period in Israel's history. I've just been amazed at what comes out of Israel and the maps and the ideas of the minds of the people almost as soon as they think them up. It's there on the internet. I mean, it's an incredible age we're in terms of information. You can either be so snowed under by this or so put off base by it that you don't know where to look or how to do it or intimidated by it. But if you can just get through all of that, say, hey, this is a tool. This provides information when we want it. I think it's just one of the most amazing things. And it does work very well for people who can get the right attitude towards it without being intimidated by it. Because it's, you wanted one article, and it says there's 100,000 articles on that. If you know you've used the internet, it's you're like, how can I ever look through 100,000 articles? Well, the first 10 are probably the best. And that's one of the things that you learn quickly about it. Now, if we can move over to page 4, the passage which I think has stood the test of time. Is Joel chapter 3. And if ever in the seminars or in anything like that where you're trying to bring what the scriptures teach about Israel to people's attention, I don't know that we can find a better passage to work from. Now, you have to be fair about this, and that is that if you consider that the person you're talking to is an unbeliever, unpersuaded, maybe even antagonistic, then you can't get away with some of the things that we normally get away with by just saying, that's our age. In those days, and in that time, when I bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. Why would we say that's our day and not 1,000 years ago? Why would we say it's our day and not 100 years from now? What's the particular aspects about that verse and what's happened in our day, in our generation? Well, really, in terms of the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I suppose people were wondering in 1950-55 about Jerusalem. But how could you wonder after 1967 and what the Jews themselves declared to the world about that city and what they continue to declare and what we get on the news all the time about this city and its importance to Israel, to the Palestinians, to the Russians, to the Roman Catholics, to the Arabs, to everybody. That is the city the focus is on. And God says, in those days and in that time, when I bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. So knowing just a little about the history of Israel just heightens your interest in what else does Joel say, because that's got to be our day. There wasn't any other time period for this. There's a book. I wasn't able to slip any more books in my book bag to come down here than I did, so I couldn't bring it with me. But I've seen that this book has been recently updated. It's not a Christadelphian work, but it's just a series of maps on Israel and Israel's development over the years. And it's being published. There's several in our library at Shelburne. But it is excellent in giving you the whole history of Israel. And it's been recently reprinted. I think must be in the 90s somewhere. It's given us every event that took place from 1948 right up to the present time in terms of maps and charts and their significance. We got just so much information to illustrate what these things mean. One of the maps in that book deals with all the possible sites that they had thought of for putting the Jews besides where they are. I was really amazed that there was one in Saskatchewan, right in the middle of nowhere. Someone had it in mind, let's put the Jews over there. And there's 20 or 30 sites around the world where they wanted to put these people. Now, that's of no consequence to us today because we didn't live through that. But when you think about it, it makes the miracle of the birth of Israel again that much more significant that it actually was back in the land. It was the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. It wasn't bringing the Jews to be a nation somewhere in the world. It was bringing the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem back. And those are the aspects of it that seem you can still round out when people will publish things like that and say, well, did you know that they were thinking of putting them out in Africa in several places, in South America, and places in the States here, and in Canada. There was locations around the world. I guess everyone wanted to get them as far away from where they lived as possible. So that was the way it was. But the way it worked out was right where prophecy said it would be. And so we see this attachment now, and we see this problem that's developing for the world. Well, I don't think you have too much difficulty with that. Like I would say that as far as the young people are concerned, it's worth using the internet and all the other things to make sure that everyone really locks into verse 1. They understand that. Question? Well, give me a little bit of time to think about it in the bridge. Is I can see it in my mind very clearly on the shelf, but I can't just get the name off my tongue. The verse 1, then, if we can establish beyond doubt and continue to build information, getting it from wherever, making sure it's accurate information, that yes, we are the ones that have witnessed the bringing again of the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, and that for centuries of time, there was no place like this. This was not fulfilled. And then, look at verse 2. I will bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. I will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. That's the very next thing God intends to do. Now, we've seen this for a good number of years, in the sense that we may not have expected it to be so prolonged and so partial in what's happened. You know, even recently in the 90s, look how many people, how many Jewish people have come from the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union. So there still is immigration to Israel. It's still growing, although it started quite a long time ago. So in a sense, we're not through this. But from God's point of view, the next thing is gathering all nations. I think we've already seen in 1997 some of the reasons why this will take place. We're seeing the position that the Prime Minister, present Prime Minister of Israel, is taking on Jerusalem now to being drawing flack from all over the world for different reasons. We see the obstinacy of both sides in this case, of the Palestinians and Israel, that city is going to be theirs. I just felt it was rather amazing to see a little article. I think it's put it in here. Cut a letter to the paper, the Toronto Star, March 5th. Arafat proposes Rome as model for Jerusalem. Now just think what he's saying. Proposes Rome as a model for Jerusalem. He's saying, well, look at Rome. Rome contains the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church, and it's also the capital of Italy. Why can't we do that in Israel? The Jews can have Jerusalem as their capital city, but we want our Vatican. Interesting proposal. It will be very difficult for the Jews to deal with that proposal. And as they continue to try to build a ring of housing developments around Jerusalem to claim it as their own, it's not going to be easy to get away with. I had the pleasure, a real pleasure, for the first time to visit Israel, I think it was not last year, the year before, and to see the significance of building around Jerusalem. I mean, just incredible, huge developments all around the city, on the heights around the city. Because what Israel is doing, very obvious to anyone that's there. We generally only read about it in the news, but the Arabs must be really ticked off by what's happening. And the Jews are saying, well, we might give back part of the West Bank, but Jerusalem, they maintain, is indivisible. We're not going to give that back to anybody. That's ours. And you start thinking about the other prophecies that spoke of that. He does this, he's going to do that. We now see the rise in Russia. We're going to speak about this. In Russia, of a new system, totally different from what we had seen all those years when we thought the communists were going to do it. Now we see a new system, and a new system that has interesting claims in Jerusalem and throughout Israel, the Russian Orthodox Church. We start to see Roman Catholicism playing a part, like we got real estate in the city of Jerusalem. And you can start to see how this is going to happen and how God's now working in ways to bring all nations down to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Not just from, you know, somebody getting an idea and all of a sudden all the nations come together. God doesn't seem to ever work that way. As this took a number of years to develop and continues, so this has been developing in the back burner. But now, 1997, with the new prime minister in Israel, and you know the events that led up to him being prime minister, and now we start to see this coming into focus. Doesn't that make you sit on the edge of your chair? I mean, it's again, it could very well be a crest for which there is a valley following, but every one we go through brings us closer to the real event. This place is really worth watching. You got the new milestones here, 1996. You want to see some of the interesting things that are there continue to be reported in that book about Israel and pretty well all of the subjects we're going to be talking about today. Now, in Joel chapter 3, going back to our notes on page 4, you find in reading the scriptures that there are a lot of parallel passages. Joel chapter 3, when it mentions, I will gather all nations, well, we talk to the world and say, doesn't that have an echo somewhere? Isn't there an echo? I never ever used the word echo until I read the seminar notes. Now I can't get it out of my mind. There's echoes everywhere. But this idea that he'll gather all nations, yeah, we've read that before. You go to Zechariah 14. You can't miss it when you start to see the similar expressions coming up. And Zechariah chapter 14, verse 2, I'll gather all nations against Jerusalem. And what I think is important is to be able to find and be assured that these prophecies that we talk about have links to illustrate that they are talking about the same day. Now, this is how I like to do it. Let's go back to Joel chapter 3 for a moment. Try to establish from the prophecy that there's something in the future of that prophecy which illustrates it involves the coming of the Lord. Go back to Joel 3. Look through Joel 3 and try to find something in that passage which tells us it's talking about the coming of the Lord and the events leading up to his kingdom. But one of the things that I think that qualify for this in scriptures is a verse like verse 17 of Joel 3. It says, so shall ye know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy, and there shall strangers pass through her no more. No strangers pass through her anymore. When you find passages that say, well, what's going to occur here will never occur again, you know it has to be the start of the kingdom age. Because one of the things that Deuteronomy 28 said was that this would happen again and again and again. They'd be persecuted, they'd be scattered, they'd be banished, they'd suffer at every nation they went to. But then we read the prophecies that say, but when this happens, then they'll never be that way again. It's an end of all the age of persecution and suffering. So we say, well, if you get a peg like that, you've got something that you can measure in the chapter that speaks about that, you must think in terms of the kingdom age. Well, just holding your passage in Joel 3 and going over to Zechariah 14, you can find the same thing in Zechariah 14. I mean, there's a number of them, but just take a sample in verse 11 of Zechariah 14. Men shall dwell in it. There shall be no more utter destruction. Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. It's those things that God says will never occur again. Never. No, not. All those things which I think need to be given due attention. And I say that's only an example. You could go over to verse 16. It shall come to pass, everyone that's left of all the nations which came up from Jerusalem shall even go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to keep the Feast of the Tabernacles. So we're talking in Zechariah 14 similarly as we do in Joel 3. About a great problem that occurs in Israel that will never occur again. It's only once this happens. Well, that's the, I think, some of the things that get you back to the book and make you want to open up your life to provide a little more time so that you can do a little more study in another chapter of the Bible, because I don't know how big the list would be, but we would have Joel, we'd have Zechariah, you'd have Daniel, you'd have Isaiah. I mean, you'd look at these parallel passages which speak of those two things, about Israel coming back to the land in some capacity, about a great time of trouble leading to never being repeated again. That is the time of Jacob's trouble. And that pattern is so clear in Scripture that you can, I think, with confidence, I would say it's proof, link them together. And what Joel leaves out, put it in from Zechariah, put it in from Daniel, or put it in from Isaiah, to get quite a picture about what's going to happen. So on that basis, our early brethren had the confidence to say the things they did, and to write the books they did. Now, Joel 3 has a message in it which is a little hard for us to fathom, about this being our age. And maybe even some of the other prophecies. And I'd like just to mention this. I'll mention it probably more than once because it comes up in another area too. That's verse 9. Joel 3, verse 9. We are looking for a kingdom to come where there will be no more war, where it'll be peace, and it will be an age, we believe, of prosperity as well for the mortal population. But this passage says, proclaim you this among the Gentiles, prepare war. Wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up, beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears, let the weak say, I am strong. Assemble yourselves, come all you heathen, gather yourselves together round about, thither cause thy mighty ones to come down, O Lord. You know, each one of these phrases opens up another door to go into, but let's just concentrate on the preparation for war. I think I can honestly say from my experience that Christadelphian community was much more into this in the early 60s than they are now. If those of you can remember clearly the early 60s, in fact, just going back to the late 50s, one of the things that really put fear into a lot of Americans, and I would think, North Americans, is when the Russians put a little craft that went around the world. Remember what they called that thing? Sputnik. Now, for the first time, nations were not really defended properly, because another nation could send up a satellite and they could fly right over the top of you. Just think of the things they could do while they were flying over the top of you. It was sort of what people feared. And that started an era which we are so commonplace now, who even thinks of it as to what satellites can do? Although every now and then we see some of the new things they can do. That was the time when people started to think, what's going to happen? This preparation for war, what people are thinking of. And we knew that they used nuclear weapons, but they continued to develop huge nuclear weapons. I mean, why would you need to kill the earth any more than once? You know, and they keep developing them. And you think, this is plain stupidity. You read Revelation 16, you might think, hey, that's exactly what the Bible said it would be. That's one of the links that we make in Revelation 16 to this whole idea of nuclear war. But today it's more subtle. We now have probably, as a Christian development community, have made more of the peace initiatives than we have out of the war initiatives. As we would say, well, look at the peace between Jordan and Israel. Look at the peace between the Palestinians and Israel. I mean, isn't this something to tell us that this is the time of peace and the peace and safety cry? Well, what about this preparation of war? Are we forget this that Joel said? Because he speaks of it as occurring just before, verse 11, assemble yourselves and come down all you nations. He puts that right there. Say, if you take the pictures of all the prophets to put them together, then Joel says it's right here somewhere. At the time of the gathering all the nations to bring them into the valley of Jehoshaphat, there's a great preparation for war. And it's a time when weak will say they're strong. What do we make of that phrase in terms of the preparation for war? The weak are strong. Isn't it implying, and I would say it may have been very difficult for anyone outside of our age to know what that meant. We've all experienced that. There have been segments of the prophecy we really don't know what it means. Like, I'll put hooks into your jaws and I'll turn you back and lead you on. What did that mean? Well, there's a lot of people wrote about what Russia would do, but there was very, very few people. Check our readings. Very few Christadelphians ever knew what that meant, about God putting hooks into the jaws of Gog and leading them on. But I dare say we have some answers now. Well, the same with this one. The weak can say they're strong uniquely now if they have the weapons that make weak nations strong and almost fearful. You can think of just the kind of weapons that people have and why this nation, the United States, and other nations are trying to make sure they're not developed in little nations. Because if they are, then little nations have as much power and clout militarily as some of the bigger ones do, and it could spell the time of trouble which the Bible speaks of. But I read something in Time magazine that put a new slant on all of this. And it was a picture of the United States as the arms merchant for the world. Maybe you remember that. It was some time ago, front page. United States, the arms merchant for the world. So the nation that's going around trying to make peace agreements, I mean, it really is hard to fathom, to think it through, of how United States would send a team to Russia to buy up some plutonium to keep that from getting into the hands of the Iranians. And the people in the former Soviet Union allowing them to take a military airplane or two landing in the former Soviet Union to pick this stuff up and bring it back here. They wouldn't even thought of this in the 60s. But to keep that stuff from getting into the hands of small nations has been a priority. So we have a nation that's going around the world trying to be the peace broker, buying off nations so that they won't develop these weapons. But at the same time, they're the arms merchant of the world. They're selling more arms to nations than any other nation in the world. Peace broker and arms broker. How do you figure that? Well, it's just one of the oddities of our age. But yet, through that, this prophecy will come true. God has a unique way of bringing peace. The way it supposedly peace works now is you have peace out of strength. No one's going to bully you around because you're too strong. But God says in the kingdom age, they'll learn war no more. They'll burn their weapons. That's not what's happening today. The peace of today must be fragile because nations are getting their peace out of being armed to the teeth. Do the Arab nations around Israel now think that because of these peace agreements, they don't need an army or an air force, or they don't need any weapons? I don't see anybody doing that. Even in Israel, where they're signing these peace agreements, they realize that they were getting weaker because they may not be able to resist an attack from Syria, well reported of in the press. And so now their training and their preparation for war is being stepped up. So these are the things which are not contradictions. They're characteristics of the age. When he gathers all nations to bring them into the valley of Jehoshaphat, after this, there are some unique things happen that are documented in other prophecies of the word. Now that verse 11, assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen, gather yourselves together round about, thither cause thy mighty ones to come down. Who are these mighty ones? Well, I think that's a critical text for us. Because, as I mentioned earlier, there are some people who believe that this great conflict is going to occur prior to the Lord coming to us to call us to judgment. And I think that's where we have to decide one way or the other. If we can be sure who the mighty ones are that are coming at this same event, then that may help settle the issue. I think that's an important question to ask people who do say that, as to what you think Joel 3, verse 11 is saying. Or go over to Zechariah chapter 14 and ask the same question in verse 5, speaking about that same bringing of the nations together, obviously talking about the days which Joel 3 is. And he says at the time of the great earthquake, his feet, I don't think anyone disputes, is the Lord's feet that stand on the Mount of Olives that splits in two. But in the latter part of verse 5, and the Lord my God, Yahweh my God, shall come, and all the saints with thee. Who are these saints that are with him at the time of his intervention? Well, I think one of the helpful passages here is found in Psalm 149. And I know that there are some people who have great difficulty imagining themselves involved in this way, but I think it is much easier to see yourself involved in this if you think of what the saints are really doing at this particular time. Psalm 149, verse 5 says, let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen, punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor of all his saints. Praise ye Yahweh. Do you see yourself there? Well, who could he be speaking of? This honor have all his saints. Is there not a parallel passage to this when our Lord speaks in Revelation chapter 3, or Revelation chapter 2, rather, in verse 26? He that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him will I give power over the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron, as the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I have received of my Father. The saints are sanctified ones. We can't be sure from that word alone who they are. Because as John Thomas makes it very clear, pointed in Alpha's Israel, at one time the Persians were his saints, as the scriptures speak. They were sanctified, set apart for a use. That's what the word means. But how can we dispute Revelation chapter 2? He's speaking to the people of Thyatira and telling them that if they overcame, he would give them power over the nations and they would rule them with a rod of iron, which is the substance of Psalm 149. So at the time these battles are being fought, the saints have got to be there. It's not something they witness as mortals wondering what's happening in the earth. It's something that God offers as a reward. And I know people have difficulty with that. Like, why would I ever want to do that and be involved in the judgments upon nations? And I suppose if people haven't thought a little bit about that, you can get pretty mixed up. Just starting to thinking you're going to go out in hand-to-hand combat with the world. It's really not the way the angels fought. I mean, David did see an angel with a sword drawn in his hand standing over Jerusalem, but he didn't see him killing people with it. It's figurative language, and it's language to suggest that as the angels fought in the days past, ways we don't know what they did, except that they were very effective, God says that we are the ones who will administer that act, that kind of action in the age to come. But why would you see that as a reward? Why would you see that as something motivating? And if we don't really understand suffering, go back to an age when they did suffer. Absolutely. You see, one of the things that I think comes right out of this is in Romans chapter 12 tells us to don't take vengeance. I will repay, saith the Lord. Don't take vengeance in your life. Just trust that God will do it in his way and in his time. And so, as many people have written, especially through the Psalms, it seems like the wicked people get the better deal. They do what they like. They're not bound by the word of God. They enjoy themselves, if you can put it in those terms, of all the things they want to do. And they die without any judgment. And we, like people in times past, might wonder, well, where's God's righteousness in this? Especially if these people were persecutors of the saints. And it seems to me that this subject is very close to a subject which is extremely sensitive in our midst, and that is, who's going to be at that judgment seat? And when you conceive of why it says in the Epistle of Jude that Enoch preached that the Lord would come with 10,000s of his saints to execute the judgment, why? Why would Enoch, way back there, speak of an event that was going to take place thousands of years ahead of time? What meaning would it have unless some of the people which Enoch was talking to would be there? And for people who have believed that God will reward according to people's works, whether it's being good or bad, on this day of judgment, can rest that God is always aware of what's happening. Although wicked people might die and never be judged, if seemingly judged in this life, they will be judged. And it may very well be that people have been raised from all generations will be recognized by the saints who go out and judge in those days. Like, the connecting thoughts are incredible. You just try to think through, what did it mean for Enoch to have that prophecy in his time? Well, he must have made that point because people in his day would be there. I can't see that having any other application. And it's been the call of many people down through the ages of time. Well, let's turn over to Luke 21. This is the other passage we want to consider here. Again, if this is going to be helpful to us, it's going to be a road sign, then first of all, we want to make sure that we are involved in the chapter's prophecies and that it's going the way we are. In other words, we need to fix two points. One point, we can see our day and generation. Another point, that it leads up to the coming of the Lord. Well, in terms of the coming of the Lord, I'm sure the sentiments of verse 30, recognizing what happens to the fig tree, is to illustrate that something is going to happen. There's going to be an event that will take place. Well, what event is he describing? Verse 27, they shall see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. So it's describing events, I believe, that have to be answered in that sense. Well, he says in Luke 21, verse 24, they will fall by the edge of the sword. They shall be led away captive into all nations. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now, it's that little word again that crops up, one word in the text, until, that illustrates so much to us that there's going to be an end. It's like the beginning of Isaiah chapter 40, where it talks about comfort ye my people, that Jerusalem's warfare is accomplished, her iniquity is pardoned. There's an end. God has an end in sight. And it's linked with the times of the Gentiles being fulfilled. Now, I must say that when I went to Israel, there were three things that impressed me, maybe four things that impressed me above everything else, having never been there before. The very first thing that impressed me was that when you landed at the airport and you got out because presently at Lod, you don't come in like you do in an American airport. Most of the American airports, you come in on a airplane right up to a ramp and you go down to an alleyway into a main building. You land out in the tarmac and a bus comes and picks you up and takes you to the main building. When we got to the main building, there was a big sign on the terminal building that said, "Welcome to Israel" in English. Now, there was only two languages, Hebrew and English. I thought, well, that's really impressive. Of all the other languages that there are in the world, and of all the other languages which Jews who have come from other parts of the world speak, why have they got English up there? "Welcome to Israel" in English. And I would think that anybody who comes and just thinks about that is that's got to be significant. You look at the background of how Israel came to be. You look at what Christadelphians said before it ever occurred, like in writings of John Thomas, where he talked about the British connection. And you just can't help but just feel a little warmth about what that message really conveys. "Welcome to Israel" in English. And the connections that we can see in prophecy and in particular that are Christadelphian. One of the disappointments was looking at Jerusalem. And I think one of the disappointments will be because the times of the Gentiles is not fulfilled. But you may remember that one of the things that we went to Israel for was to make a videotape. And we wanted to get a background scene so that people would know it was Jerusalem. Now you just think of the problem. You're trying on the videotape to be talking somewhere where people looking at your back will see something of that city and recognize it immediately as Jerusalem. What do you show? The Dome of the Rock. Now, doesn't that tell you that the times of the Gentiles aren't fulfilled? There was nothing in there that we could show that would immediately identify with Israel except one of the signs of the Gentiles, the Dome of the Rock. Now, that can't be much longer. I mean, the promise of the Lord that when these things happen, he'll bring all nations against Jerusalem, and there'll be this tremendous earthquake, and then the coming of other events illustrates that. I just think uniquely, the times of the Gentiles are not totally over. Like everything else, there seems to be stages. Certainly 1967 was a significant stage, but there are so many marks of the Gentile in that city that we should not believe it's over. There must be a further cleansing yet. Now, one of the other things I'm going to mention a little bit about this, and we look at Ezekiel 39 or 38 and 39, was whether or not Israel's at peace. And coming from Toronto and the area of that area of Canada, you just cannot help but be impressed by everybody that's a soldier carrying a gun. People all over the place have these machine guns, and you know, I guess you get used to it when you live in the land, but when you first come there, it's a little unnerving to see people are hitchhiking, and they hitchhike, they get into your car, and they've got a gun with them. It's and you know why they need the guns. So to see the city at peace and at rest is not what a visitor would ever see. The other thing that impressed me most, I think, of all of it, was going down towards the Dead Sea and remembering the words of Jeremiah, that a visitor would come to the land, he'd look at this place and he'd say, "Whatever happened to this place? This isn't a place of a garden of beauty. This isn't a place where, as the God described, it was a land flowing with milk and honey. It's a desolate wilderness." That's because of the wickedness of the people that lived in that city, and lived in that land, not just in that city. You travel from Jerusalem going down to Jericho, and you get to a point somewhere on the way where it says sea level, and you got a long way to go down yet. And looking out over the valley, it just looks totally barren, as it does all the way down from Jerusalem. It's not a pretty sight. It's not the things that God described as the land they went into or the land it will be presently. And then
only because of my ignorance, as we traveled further down in the valley towards the area of Sodom, I couldn't believe my eye. I always thought this place was desolate and just a total wilderness in there. That's all I ever expected to see. And as you go down the road to En-Gedi, En-Gedi is just, there's a couple green things on the side of the road. Otherwise, it's just totally desolate. But as you go down further and further, all of a sudden, and on the horizon looms a big hotel, a huge hotel. I couldn't believe how big it was down in this area of total wilderness. In fact, as Brother Paul and I figured, it had to be close to where Sodom and Gomorrah was originally. What are they doing, building, in this area? And there was four or five quite large hotels. Some of them had the name of, one was Moriah. One was Paradise. And the other was the name of Nirvana, I think it is, one of the rock groups. Yeah, and I thought, boy, this is the area where, you know, God leaves a message for all of mankind to remember. And here it's coming to life again. Now, you can see why it is. It must be even a place for a vacation for Israelis. It's always warm down in that part of the world. It's so far below sea level. But what it represents, to see it coming alive again, and to see the very things that God destroyed, and the reasons he destroyed it, being disregarded all around the world. I went down there, and I remember reading the newspaper in Toronto. I think it was either that year or the year before, that one of the largest parades of the gay and lesbians was in Toronto. In the world, it was one of the largest ones. And I thought, why, when people see what God has said about this land and what he will do about that, just illustrates the age in which we live. And as we'll get into in a couple of the talks, I think one of the reasons why it's going to the point where God has to act, has to intervene, as he did before in that city. Now, I've left a few more passages on there under point 4, page 5. Romans 11, verse 11. Romans 11, verse 15, to illustrate the blessings that will come to this world when peace and prosperity come to the nation of Israel. That's the way they are linked in that chapter. And just to give a few examples of some of the other things that are yet to be fulfilled in point 5 on page 5, you know, the time to favor Zion, the set time is come, is the way the Psalm 102 states, the time of God's favor upon the people of Israel. There's no reason to despair or ever to be impatient. There is a day on the calendar, and just like all those days we circle do come, this one's going to come. Isaiah 34, verse 8 is probably one of the verses we're going to be thinking of more than others. This controversy of Zion, the people in the land, that's Zionism, people in the land, and where they're living in the land, and how they're trying to take more of the land, is what's being the sore in the side of all the other nations. Isaiah 27, verses 6 to 9, an interesting little passage about how when it shoots forth, God will debate with it, illustrating very much the ideas that John Thomas wrote about when he illustrated they'd come back in unbelief, how God would have to work with them because they would be in unbelief. Ezekiel chapter 20, what we're seeing, people in the land, there are many more of the Jewish people that do not live in the land, which will be brought into the land. And Ezekiel 20 tells us about purging out from them the rebels. These are things that must yet come to pass. An age when the whole world will turn to the Jews. Zechariah 8, 10 men of all nations and languages of the earth will take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, because they have heard that God is with them. What a change over the millennia of time when they have been the curse of people. And then in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 19, God will get them praise and fame in every land where they have been put to shame. Much of the scriptures speak about Israel in a context that is future to where we live. But there is nothing, I don't believe, brothers and sisters, that gives us more confidence in what we have believed and expected than what has taken place in Israel. And the more we can draw ourselves into this by reading about it, by seeing what's happening, by bringing our children up to speed, getting them to do little studies and investigations of things that have happened in history, I think those are the things which will keep us on the edge of our seat, never allow us to dull on this most important point. In our next class, I'd like to just look at the papacy. And I found in talking about this subject with a number of Christadelphians that we understand our subject fairly well, but we don't know history very well. What I'd like to do is draw your attention to a number of the events that will illustrate why God speaks as he does about this great organization in terms of men, great organization, and how he will judge it. Why does he do that? What's so bad? What's so wrong about this? Well, I think if you just a little information will provide the reasons why God speaks so strongly as he does. And that's to make you stay for lunch and to come back afterwards.